Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Nazarita Goldhammer, Kevin Boyle. It's February 6th, 2023. We're rolling along here at Epis Radio, and we've been studying the interrelational self and the intimacy with nature. So where does that leave us? We've had extensive discussion about all of the evidence, all the proof, all the replete facts that show a specific kind of relationship humans have with themselves, with others, and with the earth. It's a typology. It's a structure. It's an ontology. It's a world. It's a view. It's a paradigm. However you want to call it, it has a certain kind of makeup, and many of us understand it more or less. I think a lot of people don't know how to get out of it. I think a lot of people don't want to change it, who are more interested in living in the present in a negative way. You know, just living in the present isn't anything special. There's a lot of what I call charlatans from the East who would have us believe that living in the present is the only way to be, and that's just false. That's not enough. We have to live in the past, the present, and the future at the same time. And so we have this earth that we've just been sucking dry. If you think of any system in your life, whether it's a relationship or a bank account, an organization, a project, anything that you've ever done in your life, and you know what, maybe you know what it's like to use it all up, and you use it all up, and there's nothing left. Doesn't grow anything. There's no nurturance for a tree of life or anything like that. And that's the way we've been living for the production of the illusion of comfort in the Western world, in the West. And we're not in the majority. If you look at the 8 billion people on Earth, we're the people in the United States and in the West in general. We're not the biggest population. We're substantial, but there are many other people in the world who would feel beyond grateful that they had a refrigerator or running water or a bathroom that's inside or heat or cooling. And so we take all this for granted that this is just the way it is, and most everybody else has it. That's false. And we also have this view that we can continue to take the minerals from the earth, the animals from the earth, birds from the sky, every kind of resource you can imagine, that we can just continue to take and take and take. I guess there's been a belief that it was unlimited. And we're learning that the Earth is a finite spaceship. It really is finite. It's not. It may have a lot of resources, but it's not infinite. And also the way we use resources, the more and more I read, Nazarita, the more I learn, there are scientists out there. They're quantitatively oriented scientists, and they're good with math, and they help us understand inefficiency. You know, here's an inefficiency. To buy apples from an apple orchard and you only buy 30% of them because only the 30% of the apples are perfect. And the other 70% of the apples, which are just as good, maybe not quite perfect, get thrown away. Nobody eats them. And if you use that as an example, it is rampant in what we do. So we've had this quest to run everything, to rule everything, to dominate everything. We do it within the human population. Some people try to rule the other. And then we try to rule other countries. And so I've been thinking last night and this morning about what I would call a different kind of basic framework in consciousness, because how we interface with the world is consciousness. That's what it is. That's what we do. We think about it. We have an experience. So our medical establishment has been largely this way, where there is this dualistic separation between provider and patient. We see it in the law. Criminals are categorized. Students in education are categorized. And it's a certain way of looking at the other. Animals have been looked at in many different ways of exploitation. Rivers, aquifers, streams, lakes, oceans have been looked at as the loci of exploitation. And in human relationships, you have so-called love relationships between people who objectify each other. They build so-called intimate relationships or partnerships or marriages, but it's about instrumentalizing the other depending upon certain features, certain attractiveness, certain amount of money, job, zip code. And that is a way, you have to dive down deep in this to see it, but it's a way of othering. You see, you other, and that means you objectify. You objectify the family dog. This is why veterinary hospitals have an impossible task. There's no such thing as, there's no kind of insurance like we have with humans. There's some quasi forms of insurance, but the bottom line is people treat their pets like objects. They go to the vet, your pet is sick. Nobody wants to spend the money. And so they die. And so vets become, you know, killers. So the show today is in this gaze. It's a phenomenology of the gaze. And it's a gaze of objectifying the other and how we do it in our most private lives and how that structure is foundational to how we objectify the other in all domains of our life. And how organizations do it, and companies, and governments. It's a bottom up. And so we instrumentalize everything. But it's a gaze, and it's something that comes down to the way an individual is a self. That's the topic. How could we possibly expect to have empathy? Empathy requires a different kind of self-other relationship. It's not empathy to objectify the other, to give him a few shillings, or to get him off the street for 2 days. That's actually not empathy. Empathy is something different. And that's what I want to raise today. Nazarita, welcome to the show. We're here talking about the interrelational self, the hopeful intimacy with nature, the alienation that we have from ourselves, from the other human, from all other sentient beings, and from the earth. And I want to highlight something, and that is I think people really struggle with intimacy. Maybe it's fear, maybe it's the structure of instrumentalizing, combination of factors. But there are people who are going through the motions of being in an intimate relationship, but they're not intimate. They don't really see the other, and that's empathy. Welcome to the show. We'd like to hear what you have to say. We're talking about nature. We're talking about human nature, too. We're talking about how we relate to each other. Welcome.
Hi, Hi, good morning. Well, I liked when you were speaking about the provider and the patient. I thought that was really, really interesting because our whole culture is set up between disparate places like the police protecting the public, but instead they're killing the public. Hospitals supposed to be for health care, but they're really for disease care, and they keep promoting disease. And then government, obviously, wanting to give power to the people, but taking all the power away through other circumstances. One, of course, as we know in the era that we're living in, abortion or birth control is being chipped away in many states. And all the supposed freedoms that we think we have that are to be provided are actually being undermined and taken away. It's really really what you call nihilism. This is the age of nihilism. Everything that we think or have security in, if we look closely, is really the exact opposite of what is being promoted. I thought of something really interesting. This is last night, and since I'm a vegan, oftentimes people think of vegans as radical. And so I woke in the middle of the night, and I thought, what's really interesting is that people who murder and kill and eat animals are considered normal. People who save animals and don't eat animals are considered radical. That, to me, that is the exact definition of nihilism, of what is normal is actually way far on the scale violent. And yet, again, we see in everything that we're doing that normalized violence is everywhere. And this is partly due to compartmentalization. You talk about intimate relationships. What are intimate relationships? It's when you really understand someone, where you have empathy, and it isn't that you're a doormat or that you promote something that is an exchange between one and the other. It is really not a debt for a friend, but more that we develop an empathy and a love like we would, like we try to promote for animals. Like, people really can't regulate their emotions. They don't have any control over their emotions, so they end up compartmentalizing. They have work, and then they have home, and then they have maybe their relationship, and then they have maybe their entertainment time. And all of this is commodified in terms of our daily life. And sometimes I really I've always rebelled against the idea of a set structure to life. And that's compartmentalization. Like, this is what you do. You go to work at 9. You're off at 5. You have lunch from noon to 1. You know, you go home and you have dinner and then you go to sleep. Or you see the person that maybe you're dating or your partner, you see them for a couple hours and then that's it, and the day starts over again. And I think our culture, especially with AI now, is more and more that kind of compartmentalized thinking. I see it in the way that we're kind of married to our phones. I know that. I have that. I look at my phone all the time. And then when I become a little bit aware of it, I realize that that's my form of entertainment, of security, of taking my mind off what's going on, of what I think of being in tune with the world. But it really is, it can be really overdone. And it can put you in a space like a fantasy novel, or a game that you play on video games, or a show that people watch and talk about that they have no involvement in, a drama series or whatever. And so we're all seeking empathy and a relationship with the other, be it nature, other animals, other humans, ourselves. We're all seeking that empathy, that wanting to understand and to love unconditionally. I think that's pretty much the heart of it. If you ask anyone, they'd love to be loved unconditionally, yet very few people can give love unconditionally, even with those that they think that they love dearly. You know, they get very upset. So those are just some ideas that, you know, I was thinking that we're on our way to revolution. Because what's going on is there's more and more control by small aspects of our society. And what that means is greater and greater penalties for even being alive. And we're seeing that through the police department. We're seeing that through hospitals. We're seeing it through work. We're seeing it through all these places, through the extreme wealthy who buy, you know, millions of acres of land and create bunkers so that they could be safe when the rest of the world disappears because of human, you know, consumption. So, you know, it's an interesting subject because intimacy comes. If you take all that away, what will you get? And here's my last thought. It's just off the top of my head. But I once asked one of my friends, I said, they were really involved with someone dating, and they were picturing their life together, how they would live in this house and have these things and do these vacations, and because the person was more wealthy than not. And I asked, and I said, so what if this person were poor? Would you still love them? And their answer was, but they're not. And I think sometimes we create our relationship based upon a quid pro quo. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. It is. In fact, it's in a lot of ways, it's how the state and how bureaucracy and how the law enters into the home. Capitalism. So we've commodified love. You see it with self-help books, romantic novels, a lot of marriage counseling, group therapy, tax laws. And so the danger is in taking, we'll say, a love relationship where there are potentials for reciprocal exchange where people really care about each other, right? They do things for each other. They're loyal, trusted. You know, they're really in it. It's like being in a pack. And you just count on each other. And then, unfortunately, that gets confused in love relationships that where people live together in a romantic way, or even go further and actually have a marriage certificate where all these laws and rules apply. So what happens, you can see different levels of formalization of care and love. And in those levels of formalization, what logic is it? This is the big question, and I'll give you the A+ answer. What is the logic that determines the rules of formalization, the algebra of it? And it's capitalism. So now you have a regard for another person, but unfortunately you've taken that regard, the mutual regard, and whatever it is that you call love, and you continue to synthesize it into these levels of formalization that are completely dictated by tax code, the legal code. And then it's really hard to say that instrumentalization is love. Now people can say, well, it can be very loving to give money to somebody. Absolutely true. No question about it. But when you have most of the relationship or all of the relationship mediated by money, it starts to look like something else. And this is an important discussion. I'm glad you brought this up. If you look at the things that people argue about in marriages, a lot of them have to do with sex, you know, intimate expression. Number two, budgeting and money. Children, number three, communication. Four, other family members and social circles. So there are a lot of ways to do this. When you have capitalism and commodification sticking its head in to your private life, then whatever was valuable in that, it's buried. It still might be there. And one of the, I don't think it's a great exercise or a trick, but one of the sophomoric exercises that a typical therapist might say is, for a couple who's having trouble, why don't you look back and think about what originally brought you together and how much you loved each other to try to find that space. So, yes, in principle, that sounds good. Unfortunately, those early days are often filled with, delusion, projection. So there wasn't really much to be real anyway. But the point is that and people do this with not only with their marital partners, they do it with, I've known lots of people who called me their friend, but I was only an instrumentalized friend. Like I was a friend as long as I gave them something. And like it was you could quantify it on an Excel spreadsheet. What was I giving? And so it was very quid pro quo, very instrumentalized. And I want to help people understand what the pitfalls of that. Absolutely, there's a certain kind of regard and care and even love in that logic. However, there's something deeper. And the deeper and the more profound and the more pure is the non-instrumental form of love in which people pursue the good, capital G, pursue virtue, positive human transformations, nonviolence, goods that are really important that create sustainability and life as opposed to death and violence and abuse. And so pursuing the good, when you can pursue the good with another person, there can be a mutual regard in their individual pursuits of the good, but also in their sharing of the good, their mutuality in that, their mutuality in sharing the good. How lovely, right? Because then it becomes, you completely throw out the whole idea of instrumentalization. You actually discard it as a logic. And in its place, you put, you're on your own path and you give and give and give in your own virtue and your own pursuit of the good. And it really doesn't matter in one way that, what the other person does. It's not a scorecard. Now, if you have somebody in your life who's not pursuing the good in a meaningful way, let's just say on a scale of 1 to 100, they're at a 1 or 0, Then you have nothing to share. There's no shared experience because they're obviously living in a different way, either a instrumentalized way, a selfish way, a domineering, possessory way, even a violent way. It's true that we are all humans, and it's true that you can sit down and find some commonality with anybody. Absolutely. That's easy to prove. But in terms of an ongoing relational structure with another human being, what sustains intimacy and what sustains interrelational growth is a mutual pursuit of the good. That's intimacy. But unfortunately now, we largely have lost that, and especially in communities of the world that are more and more expensive, that are highly regulated by money, capitalism, commodification. You have whole communities, like, for example, Silicon Valley. There, I wouldn't say 100%, but there's a significant number of people who have no idea what the pursuit of the good is. All they know is how to make money, live in a certain zip code, buy the biggest house possible, send their kids to the best schools. But even love is instrumentalized. It could be instrumentalized with bling, a ring, a vacation. But that's not love, and that's certainly not intimacy. So it involves a certain kind of consciousness towards the other. Like, how am I regarding the other? Am I really regarding the other with empathy? That's step one. And so if you can think about it in your own life, based upon the people in your life, your friends, maybe your spouse, maybe your children, parents. And then examine that writ large. How does that logic or that algorithm work in your social world, in your political world? Because it starts from ground zero. And right now it looks to me like we have communities mostly full of really selfish win-lose, dualistic, alienated people. And it really is true, Nazarita. There is something to the adage, change starts with yourself. It starts with looking in the mirror. I think that's true. It doesn't start with the other guy. And it's funny, in couples therapy, which I used to do, one of the first things that happens in the first 2 minutes of the first session is both spouses start blaming each other. He doesn't. She doesn't. He did. She did. There's a complete lack of responsibility, for their own way. So then you take that dynamic and you apply it to a political world. What do you have? So, what do you think about that? What do you think about this idea? We're starting to dig into this idea of empathy. And I see very little of it. How about you?
Well, what's really interesting is I think of the cultivation of intimacy is actually a real responsibility. And so where does intimacy really come from? And so I love this quote. I don't know where it's from, but there are, this is the quote: if fear is the great enemy of intimacy, love is its true friend. Real intimacy is only possible to the degree that we can be honest about what we are doing and feeling. And I think that a lot of people want to love, but they don't feel like they're worthy to have love in return. And that's because there's a lot of inner work that you have to do to really know what you are thinking and feeling and how you are reacting. And that's the self-responsibility. Because if we're just reactionary to someone because they're not meeting our expectations or we're shutting them out, that means that we're not really aware of that other person. And to some degree, depending on the circumstance, of what we're aware of in ourselves. Wrong expectations are the death knell of every relationship that I've ever known. That's really the truth. And I look at that. We need to revolutionize relationships. We don't want to own the other, but that's really what it's come to. And it's come to that through the government, the IRS, how you file taxes together, and healthcare, nobody can see you unless you're married or family, birth control, preference, sexual preferences, housing, just all the things that we go through that show that there's a commodification of relationships. Like, you have to have this kind of relationship or it's not going to be acknowledged. And I think we really have to look at that. And I think it's mostly in my experience that we have escaped our responsibility for what we're thinking and feeling and how we're reacting to the other. And as I was saying, false expectations. I've known a lot of people, they expect something of a relationship. And it could be just a fantasy, you know, oh, we're going to get married. We're going to have a big house. We're going to have kids. They're going to be integrated into my life. But they're not honest about really what they want. They have this overview. And then if the person doesn't meet that overview, then they say that they weren't right. They weren't the one. Right? There's all this talk about the one, which is the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard, personally, because you can love somebody, but you have to know yourself to know how you are going to give. How are you giving? If you don't know yourself, you can't understand how to give or accept love. You just can't. You're enclosed in these walls of wrong expectation, cultural suppression and expectation, family expectation, and pretty soon there isn't any part of you in there. Like you're just covering it over. Like they used to say, you know, there are certain things handed down of how they make recipes and or how they do things, but it isn't necessarily the way to do them. It's just this sedimented way of doing. It isn't the better way. It's just, you know, what we've grown to accept. Again, normalize violence in relationships. You do this for me or else. This is what you have to do. This is what you have to fulfill. This is what I expect of you. And then obviously there's total miscommunication between two people. If one is aware and the other is not aware, then you have a real problem, because one will always blame the other because they're not real with themselves.
Yeah, and that's the other piece of it that I think most people downplay, and that's communication. For whatever reason, I think people are repressed in their communication. I see it in myself. I see it in other people. There's so much more that could be said, and communication really helps people understand. And it's the words that are important. We use the words carry so much meaning, and when they carry meaning, they carry emotion, cognition. They carry paradigms. They carry a reality. The words you use create a reality. There's a whole set of connotations in the words we use, you know, like an overtone series in music. And so if we talk about the interrelational self and intimacy with nature, we talk about empathy. So the second I put a label on somebody, or I use words to talk about somebody, I should just take a breath, and I should really think about that, because those words, they carry a lot more than anybody could ever imagine. They create a reality, and so when I have certain words towards nature, water, rivers, board lumber, trees, meat, deer. And then you start thinking about how that works out in your personal relationships, your friends, your acquaintances, your sexual relationships, your family, familial or spousal relationships. Those words that you use carry both conscious connotations and, I believe, unconscious. They pre-structure. It's like a hermeneutic circle, and they pre-structure the very circle. So from the ground up, you've already settled upon a reality. And so if we're genuinely interested in transformative possibilities for our own lives, if I want to change, I need to really think about the words I use about myself. Or if I want to change the nature of a relationship, I need to think about the words I use. But I also need to think about the words I don't use. The words you don't use are a piece of the puzzle. The words you don't use, the words you do use. If you want to change an organization or an academic environment for school or science or art, history, politics, you should really think about the words we use. So empathy has this, it's this strange concept that I'll share personally, and this is sort of in a rough way, but I remember just growing up and becoming a young person, a young adult, middle-aged adult, and always, you know, thinking about this concept of empathy. And for a while being taught, I'm not saying that I agreed with it, but being taught that it was kind of a heroic virtue. Oh, he's, you know, people would talk about somebody's having a lot of empathy. And almost like it was etiquette, right? Like polite. It was polite to have a lot of empathy. Or you had you'd mastered etiquette by being empathetic. Or, and this is where it gets nasty, we commodify it. If you want empathy, go see your therapist. And I saw that over and over again in the hundreds and hundreds and thousands of couples that I treated. People in many circumstances would say, fix yourself. You want empathy, get it from our therapist or get it from your therapist. People weren't willing to accept another person's reality. I mean, people are who they are. And there are reasons why people say what they say and do what they do. And empathy is an exciting door opener because it means you can actually learn that wild animals have love too. They have just as much need for love and affection as human beings. But you'd never know that. You'd never know that unless you allowed yourself that space, that openness. So I like the word in the French. It's disponibilité. I think it's still a great word. And it means to be available. Like, am I available to love animals who I'll never meet? Am I available to love people I don't necessarily like or wouldn't approve of in my own life? And I love them anyway. Can I love people I don't like at all? Or can I love people who are violent? What level of availability do I have to interface with the other? That's why mediation is such a powerful thing. It means to stand in the middle of the battlefield of the win-lose game or war, to absorb and help transform aggression and violence into empathy and respect and mutuality. It's a very difficult thing to do, I believe. Don't you, Nazarita?
Yeah, I really do. I was thinking that, I read this article on some of the polar bears and wolves in Alaska and how people were really upset because when they approached or they saw a wolf or something, the wolf wasn't well-behaved. And I think that is so much like intimate relationships, is that the expectation that we have commodified in our minds about others, animals, people that we share the earth with, and have every right to be here, as well as humans do, that we look on them as little cuddly, well-behaved, furry creatures that we can own and pet and commodify. And the people in Alaska, and I think every other state now too, but at that time, they were really upset that wolves were not well-behaved. They were actually existing as themselves, and people were upset. And I found this to be really, it just hit me because I was thinking, this is like how we treat the other. We have these expectations, and yet when they are themselves, because we don't understand, we're not vulnerable, we're not open to them, we don't know what they're like, we don't know what their life is like, we have these expectations that if they don't fit into this tiny box that we've created of some stuffed animal, then we have to control them, exterminate them, euthanize them, put them in zoos, put them in places where they can't get close to humans anymore. And that's what we do to ourselves. I mean, it's an exact thing that we do to ourselves, expectations of the other, of you know, the other is not well-behaved. The other is not as crude. The other is saying something we don't like. And we have this expectation because we don't know their truth. If you really opened yourself to the truth of the other, we would accept them. It would be like, this is the real truth in ourselves, truth in the other, love in ourselves, love in the other.
Right. And so I think it's always, because of our evolutionary history, I think that aggression and violence and disability to see the other is always something we need to contend with, even the best of us. Even the best of us. And so it means to engage in a practice of empathy. So, you know, here's a test. If you don't feel heard and seen by another person, they're not hearing you and seeing you. That's a test. That's the bottom line. And it means there's a failure of communication. There's a failure of empathy. There's a failure of availability. But I wanted to just quickly respond to the putting animals on trial in the United States, in Europe, and definitely in the United States in the 1800s. And even before, they in Europe, they used to put animals on trial. And they would, just like a human being. And then they would find them innocent or guilty, and then they'd punish them. And so the Ringling Brothers had their circus. And, of course, elephants were the main attraction. We would steal them, kidnap them, and imprison them, and force them to do tricks. And if they didn't do exactly what we wanted to do, what we wanted them to do, we would put them on trial. And I believe it was Thomas Edison who wanted to show people how his electrical system could kill an elephant. And indeed, he killed a huge African elephant, electrocuted him, because he'd somehow violated crimes of humanity. That doesn't seem very empathetic to me. And there are many instances. Take every instance in your life, anything you know about, and ask the empathy question. Now, look, we're out of time. Thanks, Nazarita. Thanks to all of our listeners. We'll be back next week to continue this discussion of consciousness and empathy.